proceed to the second case of the day, Pickett v. Sheridan Healthcare. Mr. Weintraub.
Morning. Please, the court, counsel. Gary Weintraub for the appellant, Sheridan Healthcare. Your Honors, this Title VII retaliation case presents unusual facts. There's no dispute here that there was a legitimate, legally permissible basis for the action which the employer took. The employee admitted this. The employee admits this in its briefs to this court. We start out with the premise that this is not a case where the employee claims that she was subjected to any harassment or discrimination or inappropriate behavior by any employee. It is third parties. It is nursing home residents which she complained about. There is also no dispute here, and there never has been, that the employer took prompt remedial action in each case. And there's no dispute that the employee, following her third complaint, dissatisfied with the steps that had been taken, simply left work, never told anyone, never asked permission, never punched out, walked off the job. It's not disputed that no one told her that she was fired, that she was being disciplined, anything in that regard. And more important, she didn't think she'd been fired. She tells us, in response to a direct question by her counsel, "Did you feel you had been fired?" "No, it really didn't go through my mind." And beyond that, the next day she calls her employer, she calls the facility's administrator, and she says, "I was wrong in what I did." She acknowledged the wrongfulness of her conduct. Just 9 months ago, this court decided Antonetti versus Abbott Laboratories. There, the employer had a legitimate, independent justification for its action, and this court held that the employee could not prevail. That's exactly what we have here. In this case, the employee did not even claim that the employer's proffered justification, walking off the job, was unworthy of credence. In fact, in Antonetti, Justice Bauer indicated that even if the termination action there was in part motivated by the employee's complaints about discrimination, the employee still could not prevail because there was a legitimate, independent basis for the action. The district court, in its decision denying a new trial, concluded and said in its opinion, set forth at page 7 of the appendix, quote, "Whether Sheridan was technically entitled to terminate an employee for walking off the job is not dispositive." Respectfully, I disagree with that conclusion. Technically entitled to terminate, that's an acknowledgement that the employer had a legally permissible independent basis for its action. What if, instead of walking off the job, the admitted conduct here was punching the boss? What if it was abusing a nursing home resident? What if it was stealing? Could the employee still come in and say, "I admitted I did it. I admit to you that I did it. But still, they fired me in retaliation"? No, this is precluded.
This type of conduct by residents is not all that uncommon, is it?
No, unfortunately, depending on physical condition and mental disability, it's something that's very difficult to control. And also brings in the issue of the EEOC guideline, which I have a fundamental problem with, where the EEOC says the commission, in analyzing the responsibility of the employer for third-party conduct, will look at the level of control it has over the third party. Well, if you've got a restaurant, I guess you can tell the person you can't come in. If you've got a prison, you can revoke privileges, put them in isolation. In a nursing home, there's not much you can do. They have rights. You can't put them in isolation. All you can do is try to counsel them, talk to their doctor. Depending on the nature and the extent of the illness, there may be nothing you can do. This claim is based on the opposition clause of Title VII's anti-retaliation provision, which says that it may be retaliation for opposing an unlawful employment practice. We say there was no employment practice here. The conduct of third-party residents can never be an employment practice. The statute, as was argued in the last case, is clear on its face. There's nothing ambiguous about it.
Wasn't there some evidence here that nursing home Sheridan, at least one of the supervisors, thought that she was attractive and she encouraged or kind of brought on some of this aggressive behavior by her actions?
There was
something
some,
like that.
There was some testimony that at a meeting several days before she walked off the job, Ms. Pickett said that one of the supervisors had said, "You're a pretty girl," or something like that, to that effect. But that doesn't change the fact that she had no right to walk off the job. And in fact, following the third incident, Sheridan changed her work location to an area which would minimize her contact with all residents, down on the first floor, not assigned to any resident rooms. And she agreed to it, and her next day on the job, after meeting with the administrator, she simply walked off. There are two elements to an opposition claim under Title VII. First, there must be an employment practice. We didn't have that. And second, the employee must reasonably believe that the practice has occurred. We don't have that here. I mean, she admitted in each case that she knew the employer took prompt remedial action. In either event, and in fact on both of those elements, she fails. We cited in our brief Dempsey versus Harrison, a 2005 district court case out of North Carolina, which we believe is exactly on point. There the district court held, involving the conduct of a visitor, that there was no underlying employment practice. The appellee says nothing about that case or any of our other cases on that point. There can be complaints about a lot of things that are not employment practices and cannot be the predicate basis for a Title VII claim. Evans versus Kansas City, which we cited, the opposition was to a racial diversification plan. Bakhtiri versus Lutz, which we also cited, complaints by a student teaching assistant concerning his grades and his immigration status. Same thing here. Complaints were not about an employment practice.
Does the nursing home or the association or whatever the corporate structure is have a protocol with regard to this type of thing? In other words, are there policies written down if this occurs, do this?
No, it's a case-by-case basis, but the protocol, of course, is to deal with the incident, call the doctor as is appropriate. If it's a serious...
Well, I noticed they very much the same thing was done, except for one where they called the police.
If it's a serious enough incident, call the police and report it and deal with it. Yes, everybody's mental and physical status is different, and in fact, there may be cases where this level of care is inappropriate based on the behavior, and the person needs to go to a different level of care facility. We said in our briefs, and I won't repeat it in great length, that this whole concept of underlying Title VII liability being based on third-party conduct is problematic. The Supreme Court tells us in clear terms that Title VII liability is based on agency principles, Burlington versus Ellerth. The EEOC has this guideline that provides that an employer may be responsible for the acts of non-employees with respect to sexual harassment in the workplace where the employer knows of or should have known of the conduct and fails to take immediate and appropriate corrective action. Interesting, with respect to sexual harassment, well, Title VII discrimination applies to racial harassment, national origin, religion. The EEOC apparently carves out this guideline dealing with only sexual harassment. And again, the EEOC guideline says that we look to the level of control. This guideline, I respectfully submit, was not well reasoned, but I will freely concede that there is a whole line of cases which have followed it and applied it, and this court appears to be the only court which has looked at the question of the conflict between the EEOC guideline and the clear language of Title VII, that the interpretation is based on agency principles. And in Berry versus Delta Airlines, this court said that those two appear to be in tension. The court's word, in tension. Here, we go even a step further. This case would effectively bootstrap the EEOC's approach to retaliation claims, and I respectfully submit that when we deviate from the clear language of the statute and employment practice and start making these interpretations based not on rules or regulations but on guidelines which have no force of law, it's a slippery slope when we get to now we're two steps removed. I only want to say a few words on compensatory damages. It's our position that the facts of this case with respect to compensatory damages are also very unusual. Here there's no dispute. It was admitted that three times after the employment action, the employer offered Ms. Pickett her job back without any conditions or qualifications or restrictions. The first offer was made just 4 weeks after she had walked off the job. Each time she rejected the offer. The first time she said her rejection was based, at least in part, on her dissatisfaction with the remedial actions with which the employer had taken, but she had no legal right to dictate the steps which the employer took. This court said that 16 years ago in Saxton versus AT&T. Finally, after 7 months had passed, she accepted the offer. She did this, she says, because her bills were piling up and she couldn't find work anywhere else. Yet below, it was those very same bills, which had piled up 6 and 7 months later, that she claimed were her damages. She wouldn't have had those bills if she had come back to work 4 weeks after the events when the offer was first made. We don't have any medical basis for a claim for emotional distress. Mr. Rossiello below recommended somewhere around $1,000 for mental anguish, record at 333. We cited the Patterson case at length for our position that the evidence was insufficient to support anything more than a nominal award in this case. And finally, Your Honors, I would respectfully submit that in my view, the clearest and most straightforward issue in this case is the issue of punitive damages. Punitive damages are not always or automatically available in a Title VII case or a Title VII retaliation case. For punitive damages to lie, there must be malice or reckless indifference to federally protected rights. We don't have anything close to that. An employer cannot be held for punitive damages where it acts with the belief that its conduct is lawful. Here we have an employee who left work without permission, without telling anyone, without punching out, who calls the next day and acknowledges that her conduct has been wrong. An employer who takes action following all of that cannot be acting with malice or reckless indifference to federally protected rights. The employee's argument below for punitive damages was that the employer had knowledge of her federally protected rights by virtue of the posting of posters required by the Department of Labor. That has to be wrong as a matter of law. Doing what you're required to do by law, post an EEOC poster, can't be the basis for punitive damages. If it is, punitive damages are always and automatically available in any Title VII case. The malice or reckless indifference requirement would mean nothing. So for all of those reasons, I respectfully request that the decision be reversed, or alternatively, the damage award be modified or reduced, and particularly that the punitive damage award be vacated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Weintraub. Mr. Rossiello.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My distinguished adversary just made the same arguments to this Court that he's made to the jury below and to the district court below. This is a Title VII retaliation case. This is not a sexual harassment case. The standard of review in this appeal is going to be, or should be, the abuse of discretion standard, not de novo. As the briefs and the record show, there is no Rule 50 motion filed before or after the verdict. That is critical. Therefore, the only issue for this court to decide is whether the district court abused its discretion in declining to grant a new trial, or it abused its discretion in refusing to remit the damages. And I submit there has been no abuse of discretion. As the jury was instructed, instructed by me at the beginning of the case in opening statement, the bottom line in this case really was whether she walked off the job, as the defendant contended, or whether, as the plaintiff contended, she was fired with a retaliatory animus in violation of Title VII.
There is conflict of what was said at that meeting when they met at the elevator.
There is some conflict. However, there's no conflict. Page 196 of the transcript, there's reference to an affidavit signed by Mr. Zeller, who is the administrator of the nursing home. He puts right there in black and white the reason she was fired. She walked for walking off the job on June 28, 2006. Now, to look at that in a vacuum, she walked off the job. What are the implications of she walking off the job? Walking off the job means telling your boss, I'm out of here. She didn't do that. When looking at the entire scenario of facts, it is crystal clear that she was fired in all probability because of her protected activity. Contrary to what my distinguished adversary says, the elements of a retaliation case, as we all know very well, are number one, that the plaintiff engaged in protected activity, and number two, she suffered an adverse job action. Number one, she did complain of protected activity. She complained of sexual harassment. Now, counsel wants to re-argue the Berry case, which has already been disposed of elsewhere. Judge Pallmeyer cited two cases wherein this court has held that third-party conduct can be the predicate for a sexual harassment claim. The Erickson case and another case against Cook County. They're in the briefs. So that is out of the question. What counsel is doing here now, he's trying to re-argue his summary judgment motion that he won, which is not part of this appeal. It's not in the notice of appeal, and there's no appeal was taken from it, and therefore you shouldn't even get to that point here. This case is what happened in this case is we have a 26-year-old young lady, single woman, living in Zion, Illinois. Good employee, no performance problems. She had been sexually harassed three times by residents of this nursing home. It was a sad situation. I mean, they are elderly. They're mentally ill. It was very sad. No doubt the company did something about it the first two times. The third time, there's a question whether they really did. But that's not even the fulcrum issue here. The third time she was sexually harassed, unbeknown to the plaintiff, the assistant director of nursing called the police department. They called the Zion Police Department. And the police came to the nursing home. And the police asked the plaintiff, who was working that Sunday, whether she wanted to file a report. This Mrs. Painter, she has a high administrative position. She's some kind of an administrator. Mrs. Painter was there. She dissuaded the plaintiff from making a police report. She told the plaintiff, well, there's no need for you to make a police report. We'll take care of it. We'll have him reassigned or relocated. Plaintiff says, fine. So she didn't make the police report. The plaintiff didn't even call the police.
The same supervisor who called the police?
What's that?
The same supervisor who called the police then testifies?
No, the one who called the police was not Mrs. Painter.
A different supervisor.
What's that?
A different supervisor.
A different supervisor. The assistant director of nursing called the police. I have her name here somewhere. She called the police. And then Mrs. Painter happened to be on the premises at the same time and said to her, well, there's no need for you to file a police report. We'll relocate the the patient. So she said, fine. She didn't make the police report. She came back to work a couple of days later, and she's called into a meeting. And she sees that the patient that abused her, who was supposed to be relocated, wasn't relocated. So she's called into a meeting with the administrator of the nursing home, and the at this meeting is present the administrator of the nursing home, Mrs. Painter, one of the other administrators, the union steward, and the plaintiff and the plaintiff's direct supervisor. And at this meeting, Mrs. Painter is the one who says, well, you are a pretty girl. What are you doing to make them want to touch you? Well, he just asked for sexual favors. That's not sexual harassment. Well, at that point, this young lady, this kid, 26 years old, single parent, two kids, living with her 59-year-old infirm mother on Social Security with diabetes, scared stiff of her job. So she felt very intimidated, and she didn't know what was going on. After the meeting, she talks to her union steward, told her union steward she felt that the company wasn't doing enough, that Mrs. Painter had said that the abusive resident was going to be relocated, and he hadn't been. So the union steward then tells Zeller, the administrator, that, well, you know, Danielle's not happy about the way you're handling this whole situation. The next morning, the administrator, Mr. Zeller, comes into work, sees the plaintiff by the elevator getting a vacuum cleaner out, and says, well, come into my office. Let's talk about this. So the two of them, 8 o'clock that morning on the 28th, go in the office. Again, this 26-year-old young lady, single parent, scared stiff for her job, and it's in the record, page 170, 196. Also look at pages 215 and 216. Mr. Zeller says, I heard you're not happy the way we're handling this situation. She says, well, not really. I don't feel comfortable here. And he says, well, you know, nothing's going to change. This is their house. And then the plaintiff says to him, well, this sounds like a department store where the customer's always right. And the administrator says to her, well, you know, maybe you should go clean some stores. And it's right in the record, contrary to what my distinguished adversary says.
I've read that statement. What's the interpretation of customer in that? Is that she's the customer or that the harassing...
Probably the harassing.
That's what she would say. The company seems to say that in that context of that statement, she was referring to herself as the customer.
I don't think that was the implication. The way it came out, the way I read it, was when she said, that sounds like the customer is always right, the way I read it was that the nursing home resident's always right. That's the way I read it. But anyway, there's no doubt about it. Zeller signs an affidavit saying she was fired for walking off the job. So now, at this, she didn't walk off the job. She was scared stiff. What happened was, at that meeting on June 28, 2006, at 8 o'clock in the morning, he said, well, maybe you should go clean some stores, she says in the transcript, page 216, 215, I thought, you know, nothing was going to change, and you need to seek employment elsewhere. She got the impression she was being fired. Now, at one point in the testimony, when she was asked by counsel on cross-examination, did you feel you were being fired, she said, well, at the time, I didn't think of it. Elsewhere in the testimony, she said, well, I got the impression that I needed to seek employment elsewhere. So she sort of felt she was being fired at that time when he said, maybe you should go clean some stores. There's no doubt she was crying at the time. Her eyes were welled up, and she was upset. She said she was upset. She was crying. Mr. Zeller, the nursing home administrator, said she was upset and she was crying at the time this happened. And the receptionist sitting at the front door, who saw her walk out upset, said she was crying. She didn't say she was crying. She said she looked very upset. The plaintiff thought she had been fired at that time. She calls the next day to find out whether she had a job. By the way, before she calls up, just after the plaintiff left all upset, the nursing home administrator calls up the receptionist at the front door and said, "Did you see her leave yet?" And at first she said, "No, I didn't." And then she apparently did see her leave, and she called Zeller back and said, "Yeah, I just saw her leave." No communication that day between the plaintiff and the nursing home administrator. The next day the plaintiff calls up and says, "Do I still have a job?" The nursing home administrator says, "Well, I'm going to have to check with Mrs. Painter, who's one of the owners of the place."
How close in time were these incidents?
One day apart. The 28th is when she walked out crying, upset after that meeting with him. The 29th, she calls up and says, "Do I still have a job?" Then he says, "Well, I'll let you know tomorrow." The next day, the 30th, he calls her about 9:15, 9:30 in the morning and says, "I spoke to Mrs. Painter and it's best we part ways." Tellingly, he gives no reason. She said he gave no reason for why she was being fired that day. "It's best we part ways." And she was, that's an adverse employment action. "It's best we part ways." It's like saying you're fired, like in that case, Paz versus Wakanda Healthcare. So, here we are. There was plenty of evidence to support the verdict. There was conflicting evidence. The employer gave several reasons. The employer gave job abandonment. They gave violation of the no-leave-the-building policy, which we proved was a pretext for discrimination. They gave the fact that she walked off the job. That's the third reason. The biggest excuse they gave was that she violated the no-leave-the-building policy. Well, first, that was not given to her at the time of the termination when he said it's best we part ways. If you take a look at that no-leave-the-building policy, what does it say? It says nobody is to leave the building during lunch or on break. There's no doubt she was not on lunch. She wasn't on break. She was crying in the administrator's office, pleading for her job. It's right there in the record. "I told him I didn't want to lose my job. I needed the job. I had two kids." She was walking distance from work. She didn't have a car. So after she got fired, she had a lot of trouble finding another job. She was forced to take the job back about 7 or 8 months later. The evidence was that she was out of work about 7 months. Her lights were turned off. Her gas was turned off. Phone was turned off. She got an eviction notice. She had no car. She had to go to Catholic Charities for Toys for Tots over Christmas for her two kids. Some Lutheran church paid her gas and electric bill. She was inconvenienced. The Civil Rights Act of 1981 allows, as you know now, compensatory damages for inconvenience, loss of enjoyment of life. And she proved those things. Punitive damages, she certainly proved punitive damages. Counsel's argument, with all due respect, is highly disingenuous. This woman did not just walk off the job. She needed her job. The animus for her losing her job was the fact that she was considered a troublemaker. The police had been called. Mrs. Painter said, "Well, you know, you are pretty. What are you doing to invite this?" And she got fired. The test for punitive damages is reckless disregard of the plaintiff's rights or malice. There was evidence to show that. First, Mr. Zeller, the nursing home administrator, testified that he knew it was unlawful to discharge or retaliate against an employee who had complained of sexual harassment, number one. Number two, the company had a written policy to that effect in its employee handbook. Number three, there were EEOC signs posted on the premises that he knew were there. Number four, Mr. Zeller, the nursing home administrator, ratified, or he had to ratify, the decision to fire the plaintiff with Mrs. Painter. So his act was the company's act. The jury was explained punctiliously by me the five elements of punitive damages in closing argument and in the court's instructions, which were the Seventh Circuit pattern instructions, and found the conduct sufficient to warrant an award of punitive damages, which was supported by the evidence. The company had at least 230 employees. The damage cap is $200,000. The total verdict in this case is $65,000, well below the damage cap. When Mr. Zeller was asked how he counseled the plaintiff and handled the discharge, he stated, actually, I didn't terminate her in the strictest sense. By walking off the job, she terminated herself. I think the jury very well could have found that offensive. She terminated herself. They're trying to blame this woman for what happened to her. This woman did everything she could to plead for her job, and they discharged her in all probability because of the sexual harassment incidents. And finally, Mr. Zeller signed an affidavit stating that the reason for the discharge was for walking off the job. That's Joint Exhibit 1, page 196 of the transcript, and page 192. The jury probably found that offensive. As your honors know, the Supreme Court in Reeves versus Sanderson Plumbing and Desert Palace said that disbelief of the employer's reasons is sufficient circumstantial evidence to support a verdict. I respectfully submit that the district court heard the same arguments that you heard today, not once, but about three times, and they were rejected below, and I respectfully ask that you reject them again here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weintraub.
Briefly, Your Honors, Mr. Rossiello says that she didn't walk off the job, that she needed her job. Respectfully, everyone needs their job. That is not a justification, nor the fact that she might have been upset for simply leaving work during your shift, an hour into your shift. Mr. Rossiello doesn't dispute that she left work without asking permission, without telling anyone, without punching out. We wouldn't be here today if it not for her conduct. He says in order to have walked off the job, she must have said, I'm out of here. There's no such requirement. She did what she did, and she doesn't deny it now. Mr. Rossiello says that this case is like PAZ, P-A-Z, which this court decided several years ago. Respectfully, this case is the exact opposite of PAZ. In PAZ, the evidence was that a supervisor, she testified, a supervisor told her, you're fired. No one here told her she was fired, she was disciplined, anything like that. Mr. Rossiello says she didn't walk off, she was scared stiff. She did what she did again, and we wouldn't be here but for her conduct.
Roger, what about that comment, you ought to find a job at a store?
What the testimony was, and it was disputed, but we credit her testimony for the purposes of this, that she said words to the effect that this is like a store where the customer is always right, and in response to that, she says Mr. Zeller said, well, then maybe you ought to clean stores. But he didn't tell her, you can't work here anymore, you're fired, you're disciplined, anything like that. In fact, she didn't think she was fired. In her direct examination.
Well, did you say at a minimum it was suggesting to her she ought to think about other work?
No. I think it was just an offhand comment in response to what she said. I mean, this is a nursing home. We can have limited control over the residents. If she wasn't comfortable, there's only so much we can do. I think it reflected the remedial measures which could be taken. In her direct examination, asked by Mr. Rossiello, and you didn't punch out, record at 218. No. And at that point, did you feel you had been fired? Well, it really didn't go through my mind. She didn't leave because she thought she was fired. With respect to this testimony about Mr. Zeller calling the front desk, what Mr. Zeller said, when I hadn't seen her in a while, I asked the front desk whether she was around, and the front desk person checked and said she hadn't seen her. And then later she called back and said she just walked off or she left. So again, for all those reasons, we respectfully request reversal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Weintraub. Rossiello, the case is taken under advisement.